What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Senior Reporter Carissa Bell. Hello, Carissa.
Good morning.
Good morning. And also Podcast Producer Ben Elman is here. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. This week, we'll be talking about betting markets or prediction markets. Take your pick for whatever you call these things. I'm going to call them betting markets. Things like Kalshi and what's the other one? The other one that's very
Polymarket
right now.
Predicted.
Yeah, Polymarket. And I mean, you can even go back to like Robinhood, because they've been doing some stuff like when they went away from like fast trading and things like that. And FanDuel's been doing some of that. And we'll also talk about the new U.S.-owned TikTok altogether, discussing whatever the changes there and the fears, you know, we have around whatever's going on with the new TikTok. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. You can also join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel for our live stream. There are people here now. They're seeing our faces, and we'll do some Q&A when we can. We don't have any gadgets to show off this week, but sometimes we do. So you can tune in for that. Yeah, before we get to those main topics, we've got a bunch of other news to dive into. And I think one of the things a lot of people have been talking about this week, the Samsung Galaxy Z tri-fold phone that we saw at CES and that we've been waiting for a while. That thing is going to be $2,900 in the U.S. So you can basically think of it like $1,000 per pane of that screen.
What a deal.
I don't know who's going to buy this. What a deal. What a deal. Because the people who are really into the folds, like Mr. Sam Rutherford, who we love at Engadget, like he's been big on the folds for a while. They have basically been like, okay, I'm going to spend $2,000 for a phone, but it is useful in my life. And, you know, I will make that a part of my life. I like the fact that it folds. $3,000, nearly $3,000 for a phone that just folds out a little more. That's really all this does. I don't see the compelling thing here. I saw the MKBHD hands-on video with it, and like he kind of liked aspects of it, but it does not seem like it's worth having a thicker phone when it's closed. I don't know. Carissa, what do you think about this thing?
So my concern is, I remember when the Fold first came out and there was issues with like that crease breaking, and you know, it took them quite a long time to like actually, I think, get it the hardware to be reliable. And I worry that an extra panel, an extra crease, that just, you're just introducing another failure point at this, you know, for benefit? Like, there's no apps that are optimized for three pane existence, right?
Carissa, you just said the magic word. We've been talking about failure points, especially Devinder has been talking about failure points for so long. Let's not get stuck in the same conversation about it.
Okay.
Let's spend $1,000 for another failure point. Yeah, no, it's great. It is a great thing. It's something we should always be talking about. But yeah, Ben, thoughts on this thing?
I said it when I first saw the headline. I was like, do you really want to put a MacBook Pro in your pocket every single day? I don't. I've talked about how I want to buy on the low end of the market, because if I lose my phone or break my phone, that means that it is not a big budget killer. It doesn't feel terrible to be like, oh no, now I need to pay another $3,000. That is most of rent for a single bedroom in any major city these days.
Most of rent, hopefully more than, but yeah, in New York,
okay,
you can never quite tell.
Not in New York and San Francisco, maybe in Chicago. Maybe it's more than that.
Well, you said most of it. That's why I'm just like, wow, $2,900. My God. The thing about Samsung, right, is that they have been very good at pioneering devices for sickos. Right. Like when the Galaxy Note first came out, I think, Carissa, were you reporting at that point?
Yes, because that was the where we got the word fabric.
It was ridiculous.
Right?
That's where the word fabric came from. And the whole idea of somebody holding up this big ass thing on their face to take phone calls was ridiculous. And we made fun of it endlessly. But Samsung was kind of onto something, because people do want big screen phones, and the Note was successful, and it pushed, that thing pushed phone screen sizes larger, and as we were able to build phones thinner and raise bezels and stuff, like, it became less ridiculous. Also, something we didn't quite predict, people stopped really holding phones up to their faces, right? Like, it became the era of just constant speakerphone calls or FaceTime calls, or you're talking over your AirPods or something. So the idea of just holding up a phone even became kind of passe. I don't know about this one, though. because again, the failure point thing, again, the cost, I think they're really pushing what they can because they pioneered the Fold. And now we're at the point where even Apple is like reportedly considering making a foldable iPhone. And we've seen the tech be vaguely like it's not breaking as easily as the first gen Galaxy Fold. So everyone's doing it. The tripane just doesn't make sense to me because I don't want this in my pocket. It seems too thick. And I don't know how many people really need like the bigger version of a tablet when they unfold. But I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see, folks. Like this one, I don't know. I think Samsung's going a little crazy here, but we've also written them off before.
We have a couple of comments from Declan, who says that it's basically $4,000 Canadian. And another one from Solidus, who says close to Vision Pro territory. Yeah, we're talking about rent, but like this is more than most people's mortgage every month.
For sure. So, I mean, more than a month of your typical month of cost.
Yeah. You would hope that it lasts for a good long time. Who knows?
Yep. This version of the Galaxy Trifold, I don't think is really for normal people. It's more of like a thing that Samsung can do because they proved they can do it. That's really all it's out here for. But yeah, Ben, you mentioned like you don't want to walk around with a MacBook, you know, price thing in your pocket. A lot of people are already doing that because the iPhone Pro Max, you add a little more storage to that, buddy. And you're well past $1,600. You can easily surpass $2,000 with a fully specced out iPhone Pro Max. We're not paying the full prices to a lot of carriers. Like I have a weird deal with Verizon where they chopped off a big chunk of the cost. So maybe that's how people get into this stuff. I cannot imagine cellular providers will want to subsidize the Trifold though. Good luck with that. In other news, we also saw just last night, actually, Tesla announced that it's going to kill off the Model S and the Model X cars. The Model S was like their performance sedan, you know, for a while after the Roadster. That was like their defining car. And the Model X was the thing that they built to be like, hey, this is our attempt at an SUV. It had the doors that flip out. It had the gull wing doors. Every time I see one of those, because I live in an area where people drive fancy cars to daycare and stuff, every time I see one of those at daycare, it just seems so ridiculous. Because the thing about a car is you need the side pockets. You need the side pockets to hold snacks and bottles and stuff. And you cannot do that with the gull wing doors. Everything will just fall out. Do you guys have feelings about this? I'm not too surprised that these two models are being killed off. The Model Y and the Model 3, which are their cheaper models, will be sticking around, of course.
What I think is interesting is what Musk said about why they're killing it off. I think he said that they're trying to focus more on autonomy, i.e. robots, i.e. Optimus. which is, I don't know, seems like quite a bit at this point. And also that they're investing $2 billion into XAI, which is formerly known as Twitter. So some interesting financial choices happening at Tesla.
I feel like that is one of the many titles of the Elon Musk biography. But, interesting financial choices for this guy. It's funny, like a lot of reports I saw this too from major media outlets were just like, huh, it's kind of strange that Tesla wants to focus on robots and also robo-taxis. Isn't that funny? Isn't that silly? Just kind of a weird thing. I wonder why Tesla's revenues fell over the last year. I wonder why like people stopped buying a lot of these cars. There is very little mention of like what Musk was doing as a person, like dismantling the federal government and throwing a couple of Nazi salutes out there and the stuff he does day to day on X, the platform he owns, where he retweets all sorts of gross stuff. So it's funny how that context is being erased from the story, too, because I think that's also why Tesla revenues fell. People don't want to, I've talked to Tesla owners, they don't want to be seen as Tesla owners anymore. Mm-hmm. That's
at
a big part.
At the same time,
of it.
I wonder how many people were still buying the Model S and X at this point, just because I know the Model 3 is so popular. You see it everywhere.
Yes.
So I wonder like how meaningful those sales were at this stage. So like maybe it was time.
I think like logically, it does seem like it's time. Like it does seem like people are not buying those cars. The Model X has not been updated meaningfully in a very long time, too. So it just seemed like there's so much other competition now from at the high end of EVs and also people making bigger EVs. There's really no room for these for Tesla. But also, there's a reason why overall their revenues have fallen and tanked over the last year. And maybe we should say that out loud, folks. It's not just about robo-taxis.
Also, what other chum do they have to throw out to their investors? Mm-hmm. Like, it really doesn't seem appealing to say, we're going to refocus on the Cybertruck, that car that everyone gives a thumbs down to, or, you know, another hand gesture to, just because of how it looks and what it represents.
Yeah. And also, even like without the political aspect of the Cybertruck, people are not buying it in general too, right? So it's all I guess always all tied together.
Well, yeah, so they have to say, okay, we're focusing on robots because there are documented cases of lots full of Cybertrucks just not moving.
Now, people don't trust us because of our CEO's political views. I wonder if they'll trust our autonomous robots in their homes. What bad things can happen there while you're sleeping? What could go wrong? My God. In other news, Amazon announced its latest round of layoffs, and that's going to affect up to 16,000 workers. That is a huge chunk. Amazon has been laying off quite a few people over the last couple of years. It eliminated 14,000 roles back in 2025. I personally know at least like 10 people within like my orbit who used to work at Amazon. And it is very wild and strange that this company is just like churning through people. Again, like this goes to a lot of things, but goes to in general how they have been not great with labor. This is not just including the factory workers and the horrible conditions they've been living in and Amazon's reluctance to accept unions and all that stuff. Just in general, they do not treat their people well. Thoughts, Krissa or Ben?
That's just an astounding amount of workers. And like, I know that's still only a relatively small percentage of Amazon's workforce. But when you think about that on top of, I think they've been consistently making cuts the last few years.
It's within the neighborhood of 100,000 workers worldwide.
And they employ a lot of people. I think related to this, too, they also announced that this is a company that cuts costs. I told you guys the story of how like they even workers, like office workers who are traveling, they force them to take the cheapest mode of transportation possible to get to their hotels or wherever. They announced that they're going to be closing their physical grocery stores. So that's the Amazon Go and Amazon Fresh stores. Amazon Go is the one where you could walk in and just like pick up stuff and, you know, it's already tied to your account. And they used computer vision to charge people. I don't know what were the Fresh stores? Were they just like normal grocery stores?
Yes, but very expensive.
But very expensive. Okay. Yeah. And then Amazon owns Whole Foods. So if you want really expensive groceries, you could just go to Whole Foods. They say they're going to be focusing on delivery. And Whole Foods, of course. And this is where I have to make an admission, is that as much as I hate this company, man, I think they have kind of figured out grocery delivery, because Amazon as a company has figured out logistics and shipping and online shipping. So more so than Instacart or something, which are often dependent on grocery stores being open. And those involve people going to grocery stores and picking things up. Amazon just has like warehouses of grocery stuff now, and people will go set up your order and deliver stuff to you in the morning. Even if you make an order like late in the day, they can even do it within hours if you pay. So this is another space where I feel like there's going to probably be some investigation to how far Amazon's going into this. But the actual like the thing they can deliver you is products really quickly. And I think a lot of people are biting on that. That's have definitely saved my butt a couple of times when my kids need snacks and stuff ready for lunch the next day, and we didn't have a chance to go to the grocery store. So I don't know. Were you guys all excited about physical Amazon stores?
I remember I tried it. I was in Seattle a few years back, and it was like shortly after they started. And I went into one and I tried it, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, kind of creepy. There's so many cameras. You just look up at the ceiling, and it was just like, yeah, just like something out of a sci-fi movie. But then the funny thing to me was they still had like workers there. Like I bought a beer or something, and there was like someone there just to like card people who picked up alcohol. So I kind of wondered, I was like, is this really like the most efficient thing? Like, it's kind of, you know, it felt like a novelty. It's cool. The first time you do it, you're probably going to skip it in favor of like some other store, like 9 times out of 10.
It is funny, like how much of the big tech solution to a lot of things is just to dehumanize all of our interactions so that we never have to speak to other people, you know, unless it's like an extreme scenario. And I think there is the pushback now, too. Like, OK, if I'm actually physically going to go to a place, I actually don't mind chatting with the cashier or the people in the grocery store and having people around who can help and going through that whole process. But at the same time, if I'm pressed for time, and I just need to make a grocery delivery. People want to do that quickly and have stuff arrive quickly. They have definitely invested quite a bit in that. I guess like that's definitely paid off for Amazon. No big surprise there. Yeah.
There's the idea of seamlessness. Frictionlessness. Yes. And what are we losing when we lose friction? There's a well-known quote attributed to Vonnegut who said, I had to go get a envelope for a letter, and you know, my wife or whatever said, why don't you just buy like a 1,000 envelopes? And he's like, that's not the point. The point is to go down to the store to get the envelope, see people on the street, like wave at a baby, have some interactions with people, and also get the envelope. It's not about the seamlessness of the experience. It's about being out and like exposing yourself to new information. Mm-hmm. Before we get off of this Amazon layoff thing, I also want to mention a follow-on story about UPS laying off 30,000 people related to it ending a business relationship with Amazon as well.
So they're even having like knock-on
It's a knock-on layoff effect. It's another company. It's not technically an Amazon layoff, but the fact that Amazon is handling so much more of its own logistics. I don't know about you two, but I see the Amazon Rivian delivery trucks a whole lot. I see people delivering Amazon things out of very obviously rented cars too. Mm-hmm.
And their personal cars, yeah.
And their personal cars. So they're no longer interested in working with USPS or UPS. They are going vertically integrated, but again, at what cost?
At what cost? That Vonnegut quote is great. I think of his Welcome to Earth poem quite a bit, the Hello Babies one, which feels like that should just be the thing, the mantra we all tell ourselves every morning is you got to be kind. And I don't know, we have lost quite a bit. I also love Vonnegut because like I was reading him in college, and then it turns out he spent much of his life at the town next to mine working at a Volvo dealership.
Oh, really?
That man, Northampton, he lived in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is a lovely place to walk around.
Yeah.
And he was a Volvo salesman, I think, for a very long time while he was trying to get into writing. So in other news, let's talk about the fall of Tim Cook. How about that? Because my God,
bigger question is whether or not it's actually a fall.
I think it is a slow descent, but probably when this second Trump administration started, it was quickly a fall. Because I do think like this was a guy who was out there, like when he became the face of Apple, he was out there promoting Apple ideals of progressivism and a world that was better. And this year or last year, one of the first things he did for the Trump administration was basically beg and be kind as much as he could to Trump to avoid getting hit by the tariffs, avoid getting like, I don't know, hit by whatever the government regulators wanted to do. There was the golden plaque that Tim Cook presented to Donald Trump for, I don't know, for trade, for saving American tech or something. And this week, the whole thing, the bribe, it's all a bribe. I wrote a whole piece about the money going into it. Tim Cook also, or Apple, I think it was Tim Cook, one of the people like investing in the inaugural fund. But this week, Tim Cook was seen at the premiere of Melania, the new quote unquote documentary, which was directed by canceled director Brett Ratner, a guy who has barely had a job in a very long time. Amazon spent tens of millions of dollars. Was it $40 million? On buying this movie. This is also after the latest shooting by ICE in Minneapolis, where people were reeling from the death of Alex Preeti. And like what was clearly like the Trump administration putting its boot on the American like people. So yeah, that's where Tim Cook was. He was hanging out with Trump cronies for that Melania documentary, which I'm hearing from some people who've seen it. It's absolutely terrible. They are not there. It's in theaters. People have been posting like empty theater seats. Talk about bribe. It's all a bribe. That the fact that that movie exists for the First Lady.
Okay, but let's be real. Like all of these things that are made to be on streaming in the first place never end up recouping the investment in theaters.
Do you know how much money people spend on documentaries, Ben? People spend maybe like $1 to $5 million to acquire a documentary, right? Not $30 or $40 million, and not however, like, to get it in theaters too. They don't get wide distribution to tons of theaters. They go to a limited amount of art house theaters. Anyway, this whole situation is kind of a mess, and I'm once again calling out Tim Cook for being like, what the hell are you doing, buddy? You were the one a lot of people were looking to as like a shining example of, I don't know, better tech leadership, but between the plaque and between just being at this Melania event, I don't know if that's the thing. So let us know what you think, folks. Krissa, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, did you see that note then he sent to Apple employees?
Yes.
After he kind of got some pushback, in which he just like still kind of just praised Trump and said that, you know, he had like expressed his views or something. It was just, I think it made it even worse somehow. Like,
There's a quote from that. It's awful. Here's a quote. This is a time for de-escalation, he wrote. I believe America is strongest when we live up to our highest ideals, when we treat everyone with dignity and respect, no matter who they are or where they're from. End quote.
I mean, I understand that they have an incredible amount of leverage over Apple right now with tariffs and everything. And, you know, maybe he feels like he doesn't have a choice. But yeah, I think it shows like there's always this perception that Tim Cook like had a strong moral compass or whatever compared to like other tech guys, and I think we're just seeing that illusion fall apart very, very quickly.
All right, in other news, we also saw the story that apparently Pornhub is going to become unavailable for many UK users as of February 2nd. The site's parent company takes issue with age verification methods required in the country. That's from our report from Andre Ravella. And this is basically what a lot of states have done as well in response to Pornhub in the U.S. Not surprised, but I do wonder, like, how many territories that Pornhub can keep itself out of. And I also wonder if any of these countries are realizing that maybe these complaints about their age verification methods, which security experts also don't agree with, if they're going to do anything about that. Thoughts, Carissa?
Yeah, you know, I wrote a big story about this at the end of last year about the problem with age verification. And I think it's just really interesting that like Pornhub is the one like really taking a stand on this. There are ways that you can have age verification that done well. Like, they're not contesting, we don't want any form of age verification. They're contesting all the ways that states and now the UK are approaching it, which really have some really devastating implications for privacy. They make everyone less safe. You know, this is like a really big issue, and I think like not enough people are talking about it because they kind of get lost in like, well, what you want kids to be able to access Pornhub, and it's like that's not actually what this is about. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, security, like keeping people's data safe, not opening up people to, you know, being hacked, having their government leaked, you know, all these other kinds of consequences that come with a lot of the ways that age verification is being implemented right now.
And this, it really speaks to the tension between like lawmakers wanting to do something about perceived harms, but also technologists being like, hey, maybe not that way. And even though there are security experts like speaking against this stuff, it doesn't seem like a lot of state and also national governments are really listening. So I don't know. It's also kind of funny. Like, Pornhub is not a great company. They are no hero. Like, they've been in hot water because of the revenge porn that they were hosting for a while. There is a funny line from the movie Life of Chuck, where as characters are watching essentially the universe end, somebody is just like, they took Pornhub? Pornhub's gone? It's not even fair. Everything else is falling apart, but Pornhub? Leave the Pornhub alone, please. That's all I've got. Yeah.
Also, if you zoom out to a like larger societal question, mm-hmm. things like porn and adult content end up being the canary in the coal mine for whether or not you're clamping down on other styles of expression. And it is really easy to do this because I don't think anybody would argue for, hey, you know what? Any kid online, no matter how young they are, should have access to this stuff. That's an impossible position to take. It's not a rational position to take. But then that opens the door for, you know what, other things should be legislated against, and other things should be legislated against. It's one of the reasons why I have said before, I follow some, just a few reporters that report on like these issues in the adult industry, because it's this, it's Sesta and Fosta, it's, was it Sesta and Fosta, or was it another bill that ended up taking down Backpage, Carissa? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I think it was one of those, if I recall, yeah.
Because
yeah, not really.
The folks who report on that sector of the world and also sex work say that it hasn't done anything to stamp out the existence of people doing these things. It's just made the providers more unsafe, because the existence of something like Backpage or other places where people could post emails or something, post email addresses, allowed those providers to screen their clients better. And it's a difference between doing it from your computer and making sure that like everybody provides some kind of identification and maybe like a links to their LinkedIn profile and everything, versus, you know, going back to walking on the street, as folks talk about sometimes.
I also feel like for the UK and also Australia, where they Australia just implemented that social media ban, right, on kids below 16.
Yes.
I think this is also one of the ways that they were considering like blocking access to social media for people. So it's all connected. It's not all just porn. Yeah.
And I'll just say that also that we've seen, because of people getting around these age verification mandates, like with VPNs and stuff, we've seen lawmakers in the UK and elsewhere sort of raise the possibility of like looking at bans of VPNs, virtual private networks. And, you know, that also would have cascading consequences for people's privacy, people's safety. You know, that would go much farther than just like policing adult content or social media. And I think that kind of shows that that slippery slope that you can go down very easily when you start approaching like bans in this nature that, you know, I think enough people, like not enough people are really like thinking about right now.
And also, speaking of social media, there was a report from Ars Technica referring to an upcoming hearing, I believe, or upcoming lawsuit that's happening around Instagram, that apparently there are some internal messages that could doom Meta at that social media trial, specifically around executives and even Zuckerberg himself talking about like emphasizing how much they want kids to just be practically addicted, or kids to always be using their services and to be tied to their services. Have you been following this at all, Carissa?
Yeah, I have. This is a, so back in 2023, the New Mexico Attorney General sued Meta for, you know, alleging that they had harmed children in the state of New Mexico through, you know, creating an addictive platform and also exposing children to child predators, things like that. And this case has been kind of like slowly working its way through the courts. The trial is starting early February. So we're starting to see some of the materials that the New Mexico AG's office has uncovered through the discovery process kind of come out ahead of that trial. There was also a story about Meta's chatbots and its interactions. You know, there's this debate internally about what interactions these chatbot character chatbots should be able to have with minors and, you know, if they could be romantic. And, you know, this is after there's a lot of reports that there's kind of like sexualized conversations between these character chatbots and underage users. Again, there was like some internal emails that came out that was like discussing this, and, you know, Meta doesn't.
Yeah, that was reporting by Jeff Horowitz, who talked about Meta chatbots and everything, right?
Yes. And I think there's just going to be a lot more coming out of this trial. This is definitely going to be one to watch. I think that this is just kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we're going to see come out. It's probably going to get pretty ugly for Meta.
Yeah, this Ars Technica report highlights some stuff. The tech oversight project that apparently has picked up from the discovery here. And some of them include Mark Zuckerberg stating that the priority in 2017 was to make teens locked in using their family of apps. And just various other things like that. Basically, this doesn't really seem new. The idea that these companies were so dead set on building engagement at all costs and not really considering the downsides to users, I feel like this has been reported quite a bit, but it is maybe having like their actual names tied to these emails and having, having these things, like that's even more of a smoking gun. I don't know what's going to happen though. Like, I don't know when it comes to this lawsuit, but I'm sure we'll be following it because it seems like it's going to be a pretty big deal. And what happens here also could affect like the ways courts think of social media and sort of the restrictions kids will have around them moving forward, right?
Yeah, there are many, many lawsuits against Meta and other social media companies that are only coming up this year that, you know, make these same kinds of claims about addictive platforms and harms. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just going to be really interesting to see how these play out in different courts, because up to now, these companies haven't really had to answer for this stuff. And now they will.
Can we also just take a second to talk about how strange those chatbots were? That they were just like pushed in your face when you're in the middle of the main Instagram scroll. And they included definitely like some copyright infringement, like in terms of names and likenesses and stuff. And also just like some of the most bizarre things. I don't know who was making them. Honestly, like going back to our last topic, it was like a little porny. And I know that there were this stuff was getting pushed to kids as well. I don't think that the Instagram feed was smart enough to say, okay, well, this is an adult. We're just going to, you know, send them this specific stuff.
That's not, I wouldn't say I'm not surprised. I will say I am not surprised that you experienced that, because I remember over the last couple of years, every time I go to Instagram, I'm never there. I'm never within the Meta wheelhouse. I'm never on Facebook, but like, I'll be okay. What are my friends doing on Instagram? And then occasionally I will get just like the shorts feed or what, the reels will just be filled with people in swimsuits. Mm-hmm. That's all. And it's like weird, porny content. And it's like, why is this all practically softcore porn? I don't understand what happened to the social network.
Yeah, you can stamp out like the ability to get to certain sites, but you cannot stamp out the general like gooner mindset that the Instagram Reels algorithm tends to go toward.
It's the gooner mindset, and also, I guess, people knowing what will get them a certain amount of clicks and clout and stuff, and like, it's gross. It is a disgusting cycle. Okay, folks, let's move on to the main news of this episode. And we want to take a bit of a dive into betting markets or prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket, these sites that essentially let you put money and bets on anything, practically anything. So, yeah, I just want to like we have not done much reporting on these things yet, and I think we will spend a little more time doing it. But I've been seeing more ads. I've been seeing more coverage around betting markets. And to me, it seems like a weird place that we've ended up in society where I guess everything can be bet on right now. I don't know. Carissa, like, what is your experience with these things?
I mean, I have not directly bet and use these platforms, but I think
I know you're a hardcore bettor. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But I think about like, you know, people talk about crypto and like it making everything a casino. And I feel like these markets, like these platforms are literally making everything a casino because, you know, when you look at the stuff you can bet on, it's just, you know, wild, like down to the details of like, you know, any game, like any sports game or even like any speech that Trump gives, like, is he going to say this word or that word? And, you know, you are literally like just taking reality and like turning it into a big casino, and that just, you know, seems like that's gonna have some pretty bad consequences. Like, we've already seen with sports betting like a huge rise in gambling addiction among young people, and I just worry about how much worse that could get with these platforms.
There's also sociological research saying that as rates of sports gambling and gambling addiction go up, that also domestic violence cases go up as well. Remember that one Super Bowl commercial where the commercial itself was someone changing the channel, and apparently that made people incensed at bars, and there were a bunch of calls to women's shelters around that commercial in particular. Yeah, it really sucks.
This is all awful. I think like partially we can tie a lot of this to like we have definitely relaxed those rules on sports betting to the point where, you know, people are talking about this in chat. It is very strange to see that leagues are basically partnering with various sports betting companies. And just from what I can casually see from commercials and stuff, everyone is advertising betting, right? We're not advertising like, hey, enjoy your favorite team or whatever. Like, go check out this game. It's like, you can make money off this thing too. And again, sports betting, not exactly a new thing, but it used to be kind of a shadier thing. It used to be kind of gross. If you saw people going, you know, betting on horses or something, like, it was not a great character defining aspect of that person. And now we've just like normalized it and opened it to everybody. It seems like these betting markets are kind of like everything that apply to everything. I will tell you, folks, full transparency, we were trying to get NPR's technology reporter on for this piece too, because I know he's done a lot of great reporting on this. That's Bobby Allen. But he did mention, before we lost him on our episode here, he did mention that this goes back hundreds of years to when people were betting on the new Pope. And honestly, like, yeah, you read classical texts, like people bet on everything. People are betting on gladiator games, or betting on like, it is a way to sort of like gamify any sort of event. And I think like once money is involved and once there is like a monetary system, people would be intrigued and spending a little money doing that.
And the idea of futures contracts is also nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that they're doing now is making kind of like very short-term futures contracts based on, you know, the outcome of a sports game or something. And then somehow that is a little bit different than sports betting.
I think the difference is that with sports betting before, it was kind of like, you know, you'd bet on a win or a loss, or like maybe a few key stats, you know, who made the winning touchdown or something like that. But, you know, when you have these prediction markets, it can go so granular, you know, how many 3-point shots does one player make? How many, you know, passes, or, you know, you get to these really, like you said, minute by minute kind of moments. And that just also like creates like weird incentives for the athletes and like corruption. We've already seen the FBI has done a huge investigation and charged a bunch of athletes and people associated with the NBA, I believe, for, you know, kind of throwing games and, you know, basically like tipping people off that were close to them so that they can make certain bets and like win a lot of money. We've seen this in politics where like before a big announcement happens, all of a sudden there's like one person who makes a huge bet somewhere on one of these platforms and makes millions of dollars because of something Trump did, and we don't know who it was.
Yeah, that's true. There was that poly market bet around Venezuela, like when mm-hmm. Venezuela would be overthrown, basically. I was doing a lot of reading about this and feeling very bad about the state of everything, you know. And then I watched that AI ad you linked to, Ben, for Kalshi. And the slogan at the end of that video, which is pure AI slop, just like, oh man, we are really leaning in fully on AI generated everything now. But the slogan at the end that really broke me is the world's gone mad, trade it. And I don't know, guys, I feel like we've reached a whole new level of dystopia around this, because there have been several like big pieces around betting markets or prediction markets. Looking at the New York Times one, which is called Betting on Prediction Markets is Their Job, They Make Millions. And it's people who basically practically many of them had, you know, financial trading jobs and were not making as much or making like the level salary there. They found they can apply their data analysis skills to anything, to like reality. So there are people like researching Trump's tweets to bet on like which turkey he pardoned and just random things like that. And like, it was bad enough that we had people just like really building their entire lives around the, you know, analyzing financial performance of companies. And now it's just like, what are you an expert in? In analyzing Trump's speeches so that you can figure out which turkey is free and therefore earn a couple $1,000s. And then also build yourself a platform where you're live streaming yourself doing this too. And hey, if you're really good at it, you can make millions of dollars a year just on this, on like trying to figure out what is going to happen and putting money down on it. It seems like a weird, like, we're just like reveling in amoral decadence at this point. But I don't know. How do you guys feel about these markets?
The idea of it is based in the wisdom of the crowd.
Sure.
That
sure.
If enough people are making enough guesses that in the aggregate, everything will shake out to being kind of a normal distribution and the, you know, big part of the bell curve will be the most correct. Are there enough people of enough different ideological bents, actually putting in guesses that you get a big enough distribution, though.
That's why I don't buy the whole, like, oh, this is an example of wisdom of the crowds. This is an example of greed of the crowds. This is an example of the people, like, who are intrigued by this and who just want to make a buck, and that is influencing things. But yeah, like you were pointing to the story of, like, the person who was, like, close to the Trump administration who probably made money on Polymarket betting on Venezuela.
About $400,000 on the Maduro smash and grab.
We don't know who that is. And apparently these services also have no way to determine, like...
Yeah, because a lot of them go to crypto wallets.
Yeah, they run on the blockchain.
Yeah, they're all on the... Again, the beauty of the blockchain is that it hides all these transactions. But I don't think these companies, I don't think Kalshi or Polymarket are super interested in stopping insider trading, because ultimately these traders, like, will still bulk up, like, the overall transactions, and it makes people want to compete with them. There's also an example from the New York Times story. A Polymarket user made more than $1 million in 24 hours, in part by making the contrarian bet that the singer David...
spelled with a four.
David with a four. You kids these days. Would be Google's most searched person of last year. And clearly they were somebody, like, who worked at Google, who kind of had the stats for that and could do it. But the companies aren't interested in it. And, like, this is, like, the perfect crime, too, because you can get off scot-free. You can be completely anonymous on the blockchain and you're beholden to nobody. And good God. I don't know. I'm just, like, looking at this being like, I don't know about humans. I want to be back on Mars, tired of the humans and their stories with this stuff.
Bobby said in one of his articles that among these people who are making significant amounts of money on the prediction markets, they know, don't bet against this certain user. When this certain user makes a bet on, you know, what kind of camera is going to be in the next iPhone or something, don't bet against them. Everybody knows that this person is probably an insider. They just have insider information, so, like, don't mess with them. Mm-hmm. How then does that make any sense as, like, a way of making money or making a market, period? Then there's the other question of the fact that some of these prediction markets will argue semantics with their own users you know, the Maduro smash and grab, that was like a special operations. People, like, ran in and ran out.
Was it really an invasion?
Is that a standing invasion? Does that count as an invasion? I think most people would say, yes, that is an invasion. It is the military of one sovereign nation doing an operation and messing up another sovereign nation. Meanwhile, Polymarket said it didn't count, which is crazy in its own right. That's like arguing with the casino whether or not your poker hand is a royal flush.
I mean, what you're getting at is that these spaces are pretty unregulated. Like, you know, even you go to Las Vegas, you walk into a casino, there are, you know, decades of laws and regulations about what you can and can't do, what the casino can and can't do. You know exactly what the rules are going in, and that's pretty defined. And we just don't have a lot of regulation in these platforms, and our current government doesn't seem that interested in doing it. Like, we have okay systems for policing, like, insider trading, as, you know, we kind of think of it in the traditional sense. I don't think our system is prepared to deal with it, like, when the context of these sort of betting platforms.
I mean, it's worth noting that Donald Trump Jr. is an advisor to both companies, and I believe an investor in Polymarket, to both Polymarket and Kalshi, and an investor in Kalshi. And yeah, people are asking, like, can we ever put this genie in the bottle in the chat? And I'm like, you can with regulation. That is why we should have a robust government that can, like, take care of these things. But when everybody, it's all a grift. And when you have a grift administration that just wants to make money, we mentioned last year several stories pointing to the Trump family making at least $1.5 billion.
On crypto and related crypto things.
On crypto plus other things, and it's likely over $2 billion because it's crypto plus things that are not being reported. It's all the grift. So I don't know, folks. I think a lot of people reading these about these things may be tempted to just put a few bucks in and see where it goes. I just feel like this is a weirdly dangerous thing we're going for. People are saying this is like, you know, something from a dystopian from Fallout or something. Again, the
feels
thing
more, much more cyberpunk than Fallout.
We are living in a Paul Verhoeven movie, and Paul Verhoeven, the master of satire and certainly of dystopias, this is definitely something that exists within the world of RoboCop or Total Recall. Yeah, I'd buy that for a dollar. I'd bet on that for a dollar, basically.
So in the chat, Buddy305Love says, like Nancy Pelosi, when she buys, people who know buy. When she sells, they sell. I mean, there is a Pelosi index fund now, right? That buys what Nancy Pelosi buys and so on. That's going to become less useful in the next like 18 months or so because she is set to retire. But we're going to be able to find someone else in Congress who's, you know, making similar purchases on the stock market.
And it seems like pretty much every notable congressperson has been doing this instead, like, I don't know, or at least has used their information with some level of this. So we don't have any conclusion to the story other than, oh my God, what is happening? The world has gone mad and I guess people are trading it. And I don't know. I would love to see some regulation or something eventually. Like people are pointing out like, hey, yeah, stock trading and investing is sort of like gambling too. Yes. Yes, it sort of is. You are making bets on some things, but I'm more worried about like what these things are going to do when they're applied to the real world, right? Like, are people going to start manipulating real events? Yeah.
The thing that we've talked about for the last couple of years now on this show is how much the internet is breaking into real life. Mm-hmm. The problem with these prediction markets is that a wealthy person or a well-connected person can throw a bunch of money in and then meaningfully change public opinion based on where the betting market winds are blowing. People might not ask so much about what they personally think about an issue, but like where the odds are. And that is its own really dark can of worms.
I mean, Ben, when have wealthy people poured their money to influence real events ever? When has that ever happened? Good God. All right, let's move on to what's going on with TikTok. The TikTok US entity is finally real. Became a thing as of last Friday. It is now a company that is 19.9% owned by ByteDance, the original TikTok owner, but the rest is controlled by non-Chinese investors, including Oracle, Larry Ellison's company, Silver Lake, MGX, and Emirati state-owned investment firm, which all have a 15% stake. And hey, Michael Dell and other smaller investors, they're all part of this. And talking about everything being a grift, the thing I want to set up every time we talk about like the U.S. TikTok, we don't know why this happened. We still don't know why this happened. Congress voted not to like essentially make the deal happen, but voted to allow a potential sale of TikTok. We don't know what the burning evidence they found of like Chinese espionage here or potential for it here. We don't know because they never released that information. And instead, we're going to trust that this group of billionaires, including Larry Ellison, who was a big Trump friend and is also key in the whole like Warner Brothers deal, too, potentially going to Paramount, which is owned by or run by his son, David Ellison. They all have their fingers in this pie. Now they're just all taking it all in.
Well, let's talk about what we do know that led to the TikTok legislation. Yes, there's a possibility of some kind of espionage, but like none of that information has been declassified if it even existed in the first place. But there was, you know, just a bit of xenophobia. And this is
a lot of xenophobia. Yeah.
Spinning off from the pandemic itself. You know, we have people all downloading a app based in China while COVID-19 is happening, while the Republican administration is saying something about a China flu because it was first found in Wuhan. So there's that aspect of just bare xenophobia. Then I think another significant part of it is the fact that there was a lot of Palestinian sympathy that was being fomented among like younger kids, just starting to understand the conflict in the Middle East and where Israel and Palestine sit in that. And that freaked out a lot of senators. They were like, okay, well, it's really difficult to control the narrative.
It must be a psyop.
It must be a psyop, because what we want to happen, what we want people to think, is not quite what's happening.
I mean, don't forget that Trump initially wanted to ban TikTok outright too, right? Like, I don't know if the prospect of a sale was originally like part of that whole plan, but this whole thing really seems like...
They're going to sell it to Microsoft, remember?
Yeah, they're potentially sell it to Microsoft. But this whole, again, this is mob shit. This is like grifter shit.
That gets to the third point I was getting to.
Yeah.
The idea that this is kind of just a business coup and there's some protectionism here.
Yeah. Nice social media app you got there. Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to talk in like high school textbook terms, because the idea of protectionism doesn't end when you leave high school history class. Mm-hmm. Like when Japanese cars took over in the like 80s and 90s, that sent a huge chill down the spine of American automakers. That freaked everybody out. There was protectionism there also. Now we're in a situation where maybe for the first time in some decades, the big, very popular social platform online, the one that is mining all of the data from U.S. teens and basically the entire like 18 to 35 or 18 to 40 most profitable demographic, is not controlled by the U.S. And I think that freaked a bunch of people out as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Zuckerberg was also very vocal anti-TikTok for a while, right, Carissa?
Yeah, yeah. I should just point out now, though, that we're still in the same position where TikTok is still potentially even taking more of your data. They released a new... terms of service and privacy policy following this spinoff. And now they can use, you know, like more precise location data. Who knows what else? Yes, it's not like going to China. It's just going to Larry Ellison and, like you said, a bunch of billionaires. So,
and again, there are billionaires, so we can trust them. They have America's best interests at heart.
Sure.
But what I was trying to say is like, yes, very much. You can talk about it as protectionism, but a lot of it is just like, nice social media app you got there. I want it. It's mine now. And that's essentially what they did. And ByteDance couldn't really fight that. The best they could do is carve out like that 19.9% that they still own. So it won't even be a majority percent unless they like team up with other people. Absolutely gross. There's a whole bunch of other stuff happening too. Like Oracle, the U.S. data for TikTok was already on Oracle servers. Like that was a whole project that they did several years ago. So there was some instability. There were like on TikTok over the last weekend, basically right after Friday, the app started getting weird. I noticed like my feed would just keep repeating itself occasionally. I just went to see like what would happen. Things wouldn't work. Comments wouldn't work. Something that I really noticed, it's a lot of like leftist posters I followed, including some like great folks from like Canada, their streams just wouldn't work. I'm like, okay, can I download this video? No, can't download that video. And TikTok later came out to say, TikTok US said it was a network outage and they blamed it on that. I don't know if like specific users being blocked while the other aspects of the service were working, I don't know if that's really an outage. I don't know what that is. We also know that they basically have to retrain the algorithm based on basically U.S. content. So you don't have the same version of TikTok you did before Friday. So like your TikTok is relearning your preferences. There's definitely going to be an emphasis on U.S. creators, but they say they're not going to block out international creators. I guess we'll have to wait and see. There's a lot of stuff we have to wait and see. One thing I really liked about TikTok is like it kind of felt like the thing I loved best about Twitter, where at its best, it was just like, hey, everyone is here. The whole world is here. You could see stuff from all over. And I think I'm already starting to notice that that is not as much the case this time.
Can I say something about the outage really quick?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So they said that it was a power outage at a data center that caused this. But like it was weird glitches, like you said. Like the feed looked weird to people. People were getting zero views. They said that that was like a display error and not actually the case, that like people were getting views. like your earnings were safe. Like some creators were saying that like their earnings had been zeroed out. They said that's just like a display issue. And then actually our friend Bobby Allen reported this week that what might have happened was that typically when there's an outage like this, it would back up to systems in Singapore, which is where you know, TikTok was headquartered. Since the sale, they don't have those systems available to them anymore, which kind of caused these like cascading failures that TikTok mentioned. So I think we're kind of, so it is sort of because of the sale. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily because there's like Larry Ellison started pulling the strings right away, yeah, you know, but yeah. I think TikTok's users are kind of primed to see it that way. My understanding is, you know, that algorithm retraining process has not happened, but like this certainly doesn't make people trust the new US entity, right? Like they know that their TikTok looks weird, their feed looks weird, looks like people aren't getting views. Like that's just going to prime people to think that there is some conspiracy and like some manipulation going on, which is extremely ironic considering that's what all these same people were alleging for years about the company. And now it looks, now like to a lot of people, it looks like that's what is happening. And even if it isn't, it's not a great start for them.
Well, at the same time, conspiratorial thinking is nothing mm-hmm. new for TikTok. Everybody has been saying, oh, I'm shadow banned because I said this. I'm shadow banned because I said that. Like, then yep. there are some bigger creators or, you know, people who have a platform outside of TikTok who are less afraid of saying the banned words. The example I always come to is Jamel Bowie. He will say, yes, somebody was murdered. They were not unalived. They were not schmippity schmoppity, like trying to game the algorithm. And yeah. his videos do just fine.
I hate the algo speak so much.
I did enjoy this one video of just a guy who was like looking around the corner in his house, looking under his bed, looking inside his refrigerator. And yeah. the caption was just Americans scouring for any propaganda on day one of US TikTok. I think both things can be true at the same time.
It's, yeah. I mean, yeah, a database hiccup could explain a lot of these things too, and I'm not surprised. Like, the onboarding process for a whole new ownership structure and everything is never going to be easy. At the same time, I do think a lot of TikTok users are probably thinking about, okay, where do you go next? And I've been thinking about this too, right? Because, like, I need, when I'm decompressing after the day of kids or whatever, TikTok has been the thing. It's like, okay, I could just stroll. I don't have to think. I don't have to follow a storyline here, right? And, I don't get that from Instagram Reels because it's gross as hell. Again, I don't get that from YouTube Shorts, which felt like a really half-hearted attempt to kind of recreate what TikTok does. But YouTube is a totally different thing. I love exploring YouTube like on my TV for longer form video, but the Shorts ain't really working for me. What is the thing? There was a new independent one. Krista, did you see that? It was like
Upscrolled. Yeah, I wrote a story
up-scrolled.
About that.
Yeah.
We'll see. I feel like
we'll see.
Some of these apps that get like, you know, they get like a surge of attention when something happens. It's usually mm-hmm. pretty short lived. Like, so
Skylight, I'm the blue sure sky alternative gonna, to TikTok yeah. also yeah, like notched mm-hmm. 350K users or something, but that's 350 total users. That's not 350 in a day.
Yeah. Oh man. It is like, speaking of like, this is what happened when basically Twitter died and Musk like destroyed it and it became a whole different thing. And I think the migration to Blue Sky for a lot of people has been kind of cool, but it splintered whatever that TikTok base or Twitter base was, right? Because a lot of people are on Threads, a lot of people are on other things. I think Mastodon kind of just died off aside from like the really, really technical crowd. And then it became like they all have their own personalities, right? I still think Threads is such a weird, it is so weirdly clout chasey. Like people are just like doing all sorts of stuff to get up the likes and to get engagement. And I don't know, I'm surprised Blue Sky worked out so well as much as it did, even though it has its own growing pains. And that's a story I'm sure we'll be following this year as well. But I don't know, folks, are you a TikTok addict? Are you going to stick with it with this new iteration of TikTok? Or are you going to give it up and do something healthy like read a book, which I should be doing instead of scrolling videos, but that requires
go outside,
thoughts
touch grass.
Brain no worky, grass cold right now.
Yeah, that's true.
Body tired from kids. There are so many things where I'm like, oh man, we had this one thing. Again, it's like the Life of Chuck thing. They took Pornhub too. That's just unfair. They took TikTok. It's just so unfair. Yeah. All right, real quick, folks, as we wrap this up. Hey, I've been working on a whole bunch of things. I just did a review of the Next Playground, which is that motion tracker, quote-unquote, AI console thing. And I think it's really cool. I think the dream of the Kinect, the Microsoft Kinect, the Xbox Kinect, and honestly, a lot of the early Wii motion tracker stuff is alive in this little box. It's really cool. My kids love it. We love playing family games together in the living room. The only issue is it is $250. Not too bad console wise, but to get like games beyond the five core games, you have to subscribe to the subscription pack, and that is like $90 a year.
That's how they get you.
Basically, that's how they get you. And we talked about this around the AI earbuds as well. Like, the only way these hardware companies can survive is to tie you into recurring service fees. And hey, if the product is good enough, maybe it's worth it, because $90 a year, I guess, isn't too bad if you often need to entertain your kids at nights and on weekends. You know how much it costs to go to an activity center, to go to one of those trampoline activity centers? It's like between $20 to $30 per kid, and you're only there for a couple hours, you know? So I have definitely gotten tired of paying those fees, and also going in the winter is bad because you will come away with some sort of new illness
that you've never heard about before.
So for many reasons, like, okay, $90 a year sounds bad. Unless you're a parent who is used to spending these weird costs at activity centers and also is worried about your kids getting sicker whenever you go to any public space right now. So, hey, I don't like the subscription, but I understand it.
You said Kinect. I'm thinking Wii. Interaction style of the Wii is still eternal.
It's still, I said, so in my piece, I basically say the dream of the Xbox Kinect and the Wii is alive in the Next Playground.
Yeah.
Actually, that would have been a good headline. But anyway, I think we settled on a good headline for that. So check out that piece. I am also reviewing one of the laptops with the new Intel Panther Lake chips. It's the MSI Flip 14, I believe, and I'll be taking a look at that. And yeah, any pop culture picks you've got this week, Ben?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of the band Die Spitz or Die No. Spitz or whatever?
No.
They are a group of women in their early 20s from Austin, Texas, and they are making some of the coolest, like, stoner rock, stoner metal that I've heard in a long time. The sound stage picture mismatch is really real here because they're, like, very silly. They'll do, like, they'll walk onto the stage and they'll, like, do a little pirouette, and then the riffs just chug. Oh my god. I didn't know that this album, Something to Consume, that they just released, is their first album. It is so polished. It sounds so good. It reminds me of music that the Queens of the Stone Age band leader released before he did Queens of the Stone Age, when he was doing, like, stoner desert rock stuff. So if you're into, like, early or pre-Queens of the Stone Age sort of stuff, if you're into bands like Sleep or any of the bands that splintered off of there, like Ohm or Earth, or I'm just saying
you're
words
saying,
now.
Saying names it, now.
Yeah, if you know what I'm talking about and you're interested in this sort of music, go check out this band, because I think it's really cool and heartening to see a new generation of people take up this kind of music.
That's cool. That's another Ben music rec. I got one too, actually, because I've been listening to this artist who I think was originally a social media musician, Leilani, who is sort of like a really cool, it's like if Bjork was even more electronic, like a Bjork Daft Punk hybrid type of person.
That's
she
cool.
makes these she makes these cool, like, repetitive you know, techno-y songs. I think they're really cool. The name is spelled Leilani, L-A-N-I-A, or L-A-N-I. So Leilani, liking her stuff. She has a new album out right now called Beep Bop Boop. It's pretty cool. It's fun. Like, if you just want some, like, nice electronic beats in your ears, check out Leilani.
That's it for the episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. you can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and talking about movies and TV at the Filmcast, thefilmcast.com.
If you want to suggest more heavy, chuggy bands to me, I'm on Blue Sky at Hey Billman. You can also email us at podcast@engadget.com, especially if you've put any money on prediction markets. Let us know if you've gained or lost. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.